Good afternoon. I'd like to call Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Thursday, March 7, 2019. Record reflected time is 3:33 p.m. Today we have presidents starting on the left. We've got Senator Reinbold, Senator Machicki, Senator Kawasaki, myself, Chair Schauer, Vice Chair Coghill should be here before too long. I would like to remind everybody, please go ahead and turn off your cell phones or silence them for us. We've got Kerry with us today for records and Eric behind us on the Leo. We have on today's agenda just one item. It's going to be to bring back up SB 23 and 24, appropriation supplemental payments of prior year's PFD and PFD supplemental payments from rules requests by the governor, for the governor. All right. At this time, we're going to bring back up SB 23 and 24, and the committee first heard these bills on February 5th. We've opened and closed public testimony. We're still taking written, of course, for the record. I'll say it one time today. You can still send your comments for the public testimony to senate.state.affairs@akleg.gov. We'll be taking that until we move the bills. Took care of that. We're going to introduce or welcome up at this time Department of Revenue back to the table. We're going to go over a slideshow today, presentation by the chief economist, Mr. King. He's going to walk us through it. And the intent will be to just get a little bit deeper in this one, and we'll talk about the plan on what my intentions are to move the bill, which we'll go to next week. When you're ready, gentlemen, if you go ahead and put yourself on the records.
For the record, Bruce Tangeman, Department of Revenue.
And for the record, Ed King, Chief Economist, State of Alaska.
Okay, we talked about this before. Ed, to get you back here to kind of give us this more in-depth view, so when you're ready on SB 23, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This presentation is really just responses to questions. I thought it would be more productive for us to do this in the form of a conversation rather than a memo. So there were several questions from committee members over the last few times that we've brought this bill forward. So I want to continue that conversation. The first question that I want to tackle was one related to how does the forecast relate to historic performance. So this first slide on page three is just a screenshot directly from the Permanent Fund Corporation that shows the historic returns of the Permanent Fund. So on the bottom, what you're seeing there are the percentage returns of the fund, and on the top, what you're seeing is how the fund's balance has changed over time. I took these numbers and just translated them into an Excel spreadsheet so that I could show them in this form and add the projections. So what you're seeing here, I also added the statutory net income.
That by a second. You need to add ease, or you need to just look for the briefing?
At ease, just for a sec.
At ease.
Please.
And Mr. Kane, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So again,
page four, I think.
I'm on slide four, yes. And this is, again, just the material from the corporation that shows their historic returns. I put it into an Excel spreadsheet so that I could show the projection as well. And that kind of on the right where you're seeing that gold fading, that is the projection of the fund going forward. And the intent on this slide is to show how that projection compares to historic performance. And hopefully what you can realize or what you can notice is that projection is not extreme in one direction or another. It's fairly close, or appears to be within the range reasonably of historic performance. Just for grounding and kind of understanding what's on this slide, I also put on the difference between what the fund calls the accounting return versus what they call the statutory return. And it's kind of technical, I won't dig in it too deeply, but the idea here is that when the fund generates revenues from two ways. It generates fund in terms of income, which is dividends on stocks or lease payments from buildings that they hold or bond interest that they from fixed income assets that they hold. Those are all considered income streams. And income streams are always considered to be realized. They go directly into the earnings reserve and can be appropriated by the legislature. There's another form of investment. Sorry, I got distracted. There's another way that the fund can generate revenues, and that is they can buy an asset and then sell that asset for more than they bought it for. And when they purchase an asset for, call it $100 million, and then it appreciates in value, and then a year later it's worth $120 million on the marketplace, that's booked as an unrealized gain. So you can think of it as equity in your house, right? Your house is worth more because of inflation pushing up the value or because of market forces pushing up the value while you own the house. That doesn't mean that that equity is in your checking account, so you can't go out and spend it unless you sell your house or go borrow against that equity. But it's value that contributes to your net worth. And so, sorry. What we call those unrealized gains. And then when the fund sells the asset, the original purchase price returns to the principal account, and all of the appreciation goes to the earnings reserve. And so we call that a realization of earnings. So you have this regularized income, which is somewhere around 2% of the fund balance usually they generate in regularized earnings, a little bit right around that. And then you have this kind of bulk of unrealized gains that's sitting kind of in limbo, waiting to be realized and transferred to the earnings reserve. So when we talk
about accounting return,
the accounting return, thank you, Mr. Chairman, that's a good question. The accounting return is the change in the total fund's value. So it includes the appreciation of assets, whether they've been sold or not. So in that instance where I said you had a $100 million asset that's now worth $120, and if at that same time you also earned $5 million in income from that, you would say the total fund balance is now $125 million. That's five in regularized income, 20 in unrealized gains. So that's a 25% increase in total value. That's an accounting return. That's an extreme example, but hopefully those numbers made sense. When we talk about statutory return, though, we would say only that $5 million was realized. That's regularized income. So we would say your statutory return is 5%, and that other 20 million dollars is kind of sitting in limbo. So then the next year, if you make zero income but you sell the asset, you would get $20 million in realized earnings, and you would say, I just made 20% return on my investment, but it happened the year before, but it's realized in a different year. And that's the difference between accounting return and statutory returns. And it's really, really important to think about in the context of all of the things that we're talking about as we talk about fund balance changes and the health of the fund. Right now, there's roughly $40 billion in principal funds. There's $7 billion in unrealized gains waiting to be realized. And then there's the rest of it, the other, top of my head, it's something like $17 billion after you account for liabilities that's sitting in the earnings reserve. And so those are the three kind of components of the fund.
Senator Ramblin has a question.
Thank you. Okay, so this chart is a little bit of a challenge, as the other ones have been for me. To me, it's really, really helpful to know a median or a mean, you know, mm-hmm. of an average rate. And also, what, you know, is the past a prediction of the future? Or is there some state, national, international things on the horizon that may be changing the investment? And so I'm actually getting to my next question. So if you could provide that information, that would be helpful. But we're, the question also, I understand that there was a presentation this past weekend. Matter of fact, I heard it may have been given twice, and I can't give you all the details of the presentation. But apparently they were talking about education and education funding and what the permanent fund dividend, if you take the permanent fund dividend and don't give it to educators, and you know that whole game that's been going on where we really have no idea if taking the PFD is going to impact education at all, but that's the scenario, you know, that's going on out there. But basically what I heard at this presentation is that they did not account for the gains in the presentation. So it was a misleading presentation in regards to how the earnings reserve is going to be depleted over the next X number of years, but they failed to go over the gains. If you could just, I know that's kind of out there, but it's something when the conversation's going on in our community, and these are the kind of questions that we face with, if you guys can kind of keep your eye on the horizon for that, it would be really appreciative. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That was two questions. You want to go for it?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Now, I can actually just defer this first question to the next slide, and it will be addressed. And on the second question, just so that I'm clear, are we talking about the earnings on the public school trust fund, or are we talking about the earnings reserve? The earnings reserve. Yeah. That is one of the challenges as people do model the health of the fund. It's tempting to just say, okay, the fund says that the returns are going to be 6.4%. That's the statutory return that they project. That's actually the statutory return that they're projecting, basically for next year. And 6.55% is the accounting return that they're projecting. That's the geometric mean over the next 10 years. And I'll explain that in a second if I might. But the difference between those two numbers is how earnings are transferred between the unrealized account and the realized account. And so when you have a bigger accounting return than you have a statutory return, that implies that the unrealized gains are growing. And if you did it in the other direction, that would mean that some of the gains from previous years are being transferred into the earnings. Sure, we saw that last year. So when you're modeling this or when you're talking about the fund health, it's really tempting to just say, okay, the balance is X, that's what the permanent fund says, and to forget about the other real unrealized gains that will eventually come into the balance of the earnings reserve. When we model it, we try to not just use those simplified assumptions, but actually calculate out what the income looks like, what the realization looks like, and then how those realizations move.
Got it.
Okay with that? And since you opened up a little bit of a dialogue with the three forms of what you say, the property you purchase and the unrealized and realized gains, because I think that would be confusing for people to understand how you calculate the earnings itself off the fund. So can you explain how that happens so people realize in those three how it's taking place?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. The fund has assets, and they hold asset classes, whether they're domestic equities, we just call them stocks usually, or if they're real estate property, or if they're, you know, any other kind. We have the fund owns a mall in Texas, and it owns a, you know, 200 unit multifamily house in Florida, and so it has a whole bunch of different assets, and those different assets generate income in different ways. They also own, you know, they purchase bonds, and those bonds have maturity and have interest associated with them. So when we look at those assets, we say, well, what does the income from those assets look like? And then we also say, what does appreciation on those assets look like? And then we think about how does the fund transition between its assets? When does it sell an asset? When does it convert an asset into another asset? And sometimes that happens because you have to rebalance your portfolio. Sometimes you just have market opportunities. So we use a random number generator to basically say how often something is. And it has an average conversion rate, I think we use, of 5 years, where an asset is typically rolled over every 5 years. And so when you have those unrealized gains that are there, when you sell the asset, they get converted. Did that help at all?
My guess is that most of the public has no idea what you just said, because I'm the public. So, right. I understand the difference when you're talking accounting and statutory. I think that that if there's a way to simplify that answer is to say that, look, we get $4 billion statutory. Take out that the inflation proofing. We have $4 billion in earnings. What does that calculate off of? Is it all three categories? Is it just one or the other? A more. I know it's hard as an economist, and numbers are running around your head, but just, you know, real, like a 15-second soundbite.
Yes,
a little simpler.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's the easy way. So about almost $2 billion. I think that's the number. About $1.8 billion or so of those earnings are done through income. So that's interest and rents and dividends. And then the rest of the earnings were right now for this year, they were projecting that number at about $2.1 billion or so, for a total of just under $4 billion. Those numbers are going to change next week when the RSB comes out, and we have the ability to update some of the actual values from this fiscal year, 2019. So those numbers will change a little bit. We know that October and December were both really, really bad years or months for stocks, and we know that the fund's portfolio is about 40% stocks. So those months hurt, but we also had some good returns in January. So I'm still kind of thinking, I haven't seen the numbers yet, but it's in the $3 to $4 billion range for 2019.
No, the second, the way you answered the first one, that first 15 seconds was good. That actually,
and then yeah,
period, so
it got derailed.
Go ahead, Sarah Machicki.
If you can just explain how complicated it would be and how much money it would cost you if you're actually going to sell those assets for a statutory return, it would, over time, it would cost you many billions of dollars, right? So the realized is only counted so that those unrealized assets can continue to earn over time.
Senator Machicki, through the chair, so as part of portfolio management, you are converting assets just as a process of managing the fund. So if you buy a five-year bond, in 5 years it's sold, right? And then you have to buy another one. Or if you buy a piece of real estate and prices go through the roof, and then somebody says, I'll pay you twice what you paid for it, maybe that's a good deal and you decide to do that. So there's just, there's a natural tendency for the assets to turn over. Is this? For the assets to turn over, and that conversion ratio is somewhere in that 4 to 5 year range, just normal. And that you can kind of think of that as, you know, if you buy a house, you live in it for 5 years and then you sell it, you cash out your equity and then you go buy another house. The question that I thought that I might've heard there, and I'm not sure, is if you, as the legislature, were to want to direct the corporation to sell assets, is that where that question was heading?
No, I was actually helping just folks to understand the difference between real, why we have unrealized gains and why they're beneficial in the long term for the earnings of the fund.
And if I could add one other thing, again, Bruce Tangeman, Department of Revenue, the Permanent Fund Corporation is tasked with growing the permanent fund. They also spin off dividends. And now with SB 26 in place, they're tasked with providing cash, certain amount of liquidity to spin off for state government. And I think the exercises we've gone through over the last couple of years where we were debating different POMVs, but that's all it was debates and the numbers were swinging. That makes a group like the Permanent Fund Corporation nervous. They want to know exactly what's their cash level that they need for dividends and for now state government. So the fact that the POMV is in place, that gives them a lot more stability because they know how much, what their liquidity for that has to be, and they're then able to deploy more assets into the market, I think.
Thank you. Like I said, you opened that up by saying when you start talking economists speak, you're getting into an arcane level that most people will realize, unrealize what? You know, just how much money do we make? And maybe how you make it. So trying to keep it at the base level, and believe me, there's very smart people out there in our citizenry, so there are no issues. But I think most people that are not in that career field are, what the heck are you talking about? So I'd prefer to keep this as simple as we can to the explanations, just because people are going to, you know, that want to watch this are going to look at this and look at the briefing and going, I need to understand it in plain English.
I do have a couple numbers that will help. I have a finance background with only a minor in economics, so I only pretend to know what he's talking about. But at the end of December, we saw, you know, October, November were bad months, and the balance was $60,400,000,000 for the entire permanent fund, and it's back up close to 65 already. So you see some of the swings where just a couple months can really drive it down, but it can recover quite well, too, now that it's a pretty large corpus.
Can I, Mr. Chairman?
Sir Machiggy.
So I think a way to explain what we're talking about is if you bought a house in 1980 for $200,000 that's now worth $400,000, it's an unrealized gain unless you borrow against the difference in equity or you sell the house and suddenly have $400,000. So the difference is if you sell it or you borrow against it, you have a realized gain that you can employ. If you keep it, it's nice that it's worth more, but it really has no real spendable value. Is that fair?
That's perfect, Senator. Thank you.
The house analogy, I think, helps. That's a good one, yeah. So because people understand that. Okay, next slide. Spent a lot of time on that one.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I had one more point on the slide, right. And that's just simply the reason why I put the slide together was to illustrate the difference in magnitude and kind of volatility between the accounting return and the statutory return. You notice those gold bars, that's your accounting return, they're very much more volatile. You have a high of 25%, a low of negative 18%. But if you compare that to the green bars, the statutory net income, there's a lot less volatility. And that has to do with when you get $10 billion in gains in 1 year, you don't realize it all. A lot of that is appreciation on assets. So it just sits in the unrealized account. It doesn't sit in the earnings reserve. And the same thing when you lose $10 billion. You don't lose all of that from the earnings reserve in 1 year. You lose it in the unrealized gains until those assets are sold and they become realized losses. They don't affect the earnings reserve. So that's kind of why I was pointing out the fact that the volatility of the statutory returns are much lower, and the reason why we even bother with statutory returns, the only reason we calculate them at all, as far as I'm concerned, is to calculate the PFD, and we wanted less volatility in those PFD calculations, so we use statutory returns instead of accounting returns.
In a way too simplistic analogy, Jimmy Buffett said when all the stock market crashed years ago, how much money did you lose? He said, none. I didn't sell anything, because he's still holding on, waiting for it to go up, so same kind of thing, right?
Thank
when you're
sure.
ready.
Appreciate it. To Senator
Chairman Chickie, I think he wants to correct my analogy.
No, just for the record, I just have to say it's the first time I've heard Jimmy Buffett.
So. Oh, did I say Jimmy Buffett? Oh, well, you know, I'd like margaritas and listen to the music, I guess. Sorry. Is it afternoon somewhere? Jeez. Is it Friday yet? Sorry, guys. You know what I meant. The other guy, Jimmy, please continue. Probably needed that after this morning's finance briefings, didn't we? Please go ahead. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'll just point out 2009, worst financial correction that we've had in this 40 years, negative 18% accounting return, negative 8%. Or 9% statutory return. So just to point out the fact that volatility does get smoothed out over time. So looking at accounting return is what we care about when we talk about the total fund balance and how it changes over time. So I just threw those 40 years of accounting returns into my software and developed this histogram. So this is just a distribution of how often different interest rates occurred. So each, you can kind of think of it as like little building blocks. And if you had one it's a frequency distribution. So if you had one observation of negative 15, it would be that box there. And if you look at number 5, you see how that box is like 3 times the size. That means that there are 3 instances of that value. So that the negative 5% kind of returns happened 3 times. So did the negative between negative 1 and negative 3, and then you see the positive. So the higher the bar is, the more often that type of return occurs. So what you'll notice is that 90% of the time, the fund returns have been between negative 3% and positive 20%. Two out of 40 times, we've had it in excess of 20.5%, and 2 out of 40 times, we've had it less than negative 3%. So most of the time the most often the fund has returned is between 10 and 15%. The next most often is between 5 and 10%. And I hope that that's helpful. The average of all of these, the simple average, just simply taking the average of those returns is 9.665%. And then the measure that we use to account for volatility is called the standard deviation. That talks about how wide the spread is. That is a standard deviation of 7.872%. So it's a very wide range. But that just means that over time, the Permanent Fund Corporation has done a phenomenal job for Alaska.
Go ahead, Senator Reimbold.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with those numbers, actually. And so I'm basically looking at modeling, like you guys were talking about, the future possibilities. Is there anything on the horizon, you know, with state, international, national issues, or do you think we're going to average 5% in the next 5 years or 9%? I know it's a probability, but just it's really important for our discussions today.
Right. Senator Reimbold, through the chair. So the kind of the general idea in the marketplace is that stocks are very highly valued right now. They've been increasing in value for quite a long time. They are really highly valued. At some point, there's an expectation that you need to reduce your expectation for future returns. And so what you'll see is most advisors are saying, I know you've had 8 or 9% returns in the past. You should probably think more in the 6 or 7% range over the next 5 years. And then once that correction happens, whenever that does happen, then we can return to bigger fund growth. But there's an expectation that a correction is going to happen. We don't know when, so we can't really plan around it. And more money is lost in the stock market by trying to predict when those corrections are going to happen than is made in any other way. So the fund is paying attention to it, and they're doing what they can to prepare and diversify that portfolio. But it does make sense for in the immediate term to kind of reduce your return expectations in the near term. That's why you see the fund saying we have a 6.55% return expectation, even though we've had 9.5% in the past. That doesn't mean that over the next 30 years you can expect 6.5%, but definitely over the next 5 or 10.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just a question.
Senator Chickie.
I just have a question. When you look at the long term, even before the Great Depression in 29, you see a pretty consistent return, although it bobbles. Shouldn't a sovereign fund not be adjusting for the short term when you think about it being a perpetual source of revenue? I mean, isn't that sort of, in a way, trying to time an unpredictable market?
Senator Michicki, through the chair, if there was a member of the board, I would ask them to answer that question.
Again, Bruce Tangeman, Department of Revenue. I don't think there's huge corrections that are being accounted, or they're making huge corrections or changes at the permanent fund itself. They may be changing their asset allocations on a as-needed basis, but I think the percent of their liquidity, what they have set aside, and what they have in fixed income, what they have in private equities, I'm not sure those have changed that much over the last several years, and I don't really think they're planning to make a big pullback and put it all in cash. They're in this for the long haul, and this goes back to their goal is to grow this fund. So they're not looking to make quick changes in the short term. They know that there's going to be ups and downs coming.
Do they perhaps change that at all based on this? Because it's a good question. For the board, not you, I get it. But do you know if they were planning on potentially readjusting that strategy now that SB 26 was passed and we're at this POMV model? Would that potentially change their outlook and how they would do it?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think any changes in how they allocate their assets would take place based on that. I think it just gives them a better handle on how much cash they can deploy into the asset allocations that were already in place.
Okay, copy.
Because really, in the big scheme of things, the POMV is about $3 billion, and we're looking at $65 billion for the entire fund. So it's a fairly small amount when it comes to that.
Mr. Chairman, moving to slide 6. So I was starting to explain this idea in a previous committee, and I understand that it was difficult to follow. It's kind of complex. But when you have volatility, in percentage terms, there's a difference between an increase of a number and a decrease in number. You can't just simply add them together and then divide by 2 and then figure out what the average is, right? So if you had $100 and you made a 50% return, now you have $150, and then you had a 50% loss, now you have $75. And if you just said, well, a 50% return and then a negative 50% return, that's zero. You would expect to have $100. But in reality, in your bank account, you only have $75. And so you have to think, you can't just simply add up and divide. That doesn't give you the answer that generates the actual long-term average that we think about when we think about compounding interest. So the way that we deal with that is we instead of looking at those arithmetic means, we convert them to what we call a geometric mean. And so then you would say, okay, your fund balance at the beginning was 100, now your fund balance at the end is 75, that's a negative 25%, right? And over 2 years, that's negative 12.5% a year. That's a simplification, but that's kind of the idea. So that's how you go from these, instead of doing the arithmetic mean, you get to this geometric mean. So I did that for the fund corporation. And here, if you had a $100 initial investment and then you got the types of returns that the corporation got over the last 40 years, the geometric mean over that time period is 9.37%, which is less than the 9.6% that we saw earlier, but still very impressive. And then I did point out on here that just because you do observe losses occasionally, that doesn't mean that the fund goes extinct. It just means that you have to recover those funds through future returns. And the worst financial correction that we've seen in 2009 was fully recovered by 3 years later. So it's worth thinking about those deep corrections. But it's also important not to overvalue what that means.
And I think a takeaway, if I go back to plain English again with all that explanation, is that I like a historic geometric mean versus projected. And we expect historically we're going to do better than the numbers the fund is using as it's making its calculations. So that's what we're looking at, right? I think it was 655. Yep. So, and that was in the came up in the conversation in finance, and it came up in conversation here, is that they're actually being somewhat conservative in what they would expect to happen, and assuming the market stays on a relatively stable trajectory, we'll probably actually do a little better than what's being used for the numbers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, so what that says to me is that at some point in the next, call it 5 years or 10 years, they're expecting a very significant negative number. So this it shouldn't be interpreted as meaning that we expect 6.55% to happen every year for the next 10 years. What that means is we're going to get 10% next year and 8% the year after that, and then negative 10, and then 6, and then 4, whatever those numbers are. I'm just throwing out random numbers. If those happen to be exactly right when someone hears this 5 years from now, it was on purpose. Otherwise, it was just random.
Your luck.
So that's what you're seeing there is the geometric mean on the projection is accounting for a correction in the marketplace, and it doesn't mean that that's necessarily what we expect exactly to see. And that's why the next section is really important, and this is in response to Senator Michicki's question on how the fund performs under different so I'm actually out of order. So I'll first turn to Senator Michicki's question on how the fund performs under various spending assumptions. Because when we provided the information on the very first committee hearing on this bill, I was talking about how that 6.55% return looks over time. And I was using an assumption that the legislature follows all of the existing laws. They don't overdraw the POMV. They pay the full PFD. They inflation-proof the principal. They follow all of those laws. And then I provided a scenario on how that plays out and indicated that the risk exposure to the fund from passing Senate Bill 23 was not really significant. And so what Senator Michicki pointed out very correctly was that, well, what if we don't? And so what if that funding, what if those expenditures exceed the POMV that's currently in law, the percentage of market value? And so what I did here is I just removed the restriction, the POMV limit, and said, okay, let's look at what different budgets do. And the gold bar on the top shows you what the fund does over time at a $3 billion UGF budget. And then you can compare that to the gold dotted line. That's the same assumption, but with SB 23 in place. And so you can see the delta is about that $2 billion that you would expect. That's the money that we're taking out of the fund and distributing to the people. The green bar, or the green line, represents a $3.5 billion budget, and then again, the green dotted line represents that with the PO or with the SB 23 in place. And then you start to get to where we start to have a problem with the fund health. The red line represents a $4 billion UGF budget rather than just the $3 billion POMV that we're dealing with now. So it's a $1 billion overdraw in effect. And you can see what that does to the fund balance. Eventually, the ERA runs out, and that would be accelerated by SB 23. If you're going to overdraw the fund and you're going to distribute money from the fund, yes, it's going to run out faster. And it gets even worse the more money you draw out of the fund. So there's the 4.5 is the black line, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Michicki, go ahead.
So I'm assuming you're going with the 6.55% Kalen earnings.
Yes.
Yeah, as you can imagine, and I know that Commissioner Tangeman, almost called him Bruce, is kind of more used to these. I ran it the other way with certain reductions. Mm-hmm. And of course, the danger is in two places. First, you don't get the reductions, and you're depending more on the earnings reserve and your higher spending. And the other is not being able to land a three-quarter vote on the CBR, which puts more pressure on the earnings reserve. And I went down as low as only having a $300 million reduction in the budget, which, of course, has you running out by, 27 or 28. So, mm-hmm. Hence my worry. You didn't go quite as far as I did on, you're going on UGF up, I'm going on UGF down. If you go with a similar budget from today with the payback, it gets pretty ugly, but it gets ugly either way. It just gets ugly earlier with the payback. And that was my concern. I think he illustrated it fine here, just the other way of looking at it. And I think that's something that people need to think about, that, you know, the Senate may have a desire for a certain outcome that may be more aligned with the administration. The other body may go the other way, which makes it very complicated, and you run into potentially unstructured draws or additional spending, which puts the ERA in trouble earlier and then complicates the payment of any dividends earlier in history. So that's kind of the thing that we have to weigh. If we don't get there politically, dividends are at risk earlier. Any dividend is at risk earlier. And we may want a certain thing to happen. Whether or not that's politically possible is the question.
Is there a question there?
Do you disagree with those real fears?
For the record, Bruce Tangeman, no, I think if the have-it-all scenario, statutory dividend, budget continues at 19 and grows under some scenario, inflation or what have you, back pays, you can't have it all. So I think that's what you're referring to, is that that's kind of the worst-case scenario on how the ERA, how the fund would react in our savings account. So that is the dance that we're doing right now. The governor has proposed his solution to this, and the discussion will continue throughout session. But I think we can all agree that the full budget, the full dividend, and the full back pay creates a problem.
One follow up.
That's yeah. Go ahead, Senator Machuca.
Just on the assumptions, your growth rate 2.25 as well in this for inflation.
Oh, yeah, Senator Machuca, that's correct.
Thank you.
And we have time on this, so I, you know, this is the only thing we're doing today. I mean, hope we're not going to stand, start making long speeches and pontificating forever, but I do not mind the discussion. That's, I just want to make sure there's a question, so, because I'd like to get this one. We have a little more time to go in depth on these here than we do in finance with the time available, so that's one of the reasons I thought this was appropriate. Senator Coghill had a quick question.
The dumb question. I'm looking at this. It says the assumption is full dividend paid. Is that included in the 3G UGF or the 3.5 UGF, or is that outside of that?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, that's a great question. No, that's in addition to that 3.5 or whatever that number is.
Okay, so this is just what you would use for operating government, not what you use for the dividend. So right. The assumption is full dividend. So that is a different general number that most of us would think of. So I think that's something I needed to kind of factor in. So thank you.
Do you want to explain that a little further, just for the record then on that one, because I'm not sure if people were following what that exchange just took place?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So when I say a $3 billion UGF, there's a question in the building and in the public on whether permanent fund dividend payments are considered unrestricted general fund payments or not. So the question was, does that $3 billion include the PFD payment, or is the PFD payment in addition to that number? And my answer was, it is in addition to that number.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I know. So the way the exchange went with how the chart shows two lines, I want people to hear that crystal clear if they have a question on it. So I'm going to ask a question here. Actually, Senator Kawasaki. I had a question. I apologize.
Yeah, some of my questions were clarified with the two previous speakers, but just one other question about Senate Bill 26. Is this $3 billion extra outside of the Senate Bill 26, or is this Senate Bill 26 inclusive?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. So this scenario, what we were trying to do is say, if the fund is overdrawn, then how does that affect the health of the fund? And so in order to do that, I turned off the POMV and just allowed overdraws to occur.
Through the chair. This current year, what's anticipated draw for the POMV under Senate Bill 26?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, it's about $2.9 billion.
So through the chair, it's about $3 billion now.
Correct.
And then I'm just looking at one of the UGF revenue forecasts from 2018 fall. I mean, basically for the next 10 years, it looks like between $3 billion and $3.8 billion under the Senate Bill 26 scenario. Is that pretty much right?
That's correct, Senator.
And then just through the chair, mm-hmm. Again, looking at this graph, just Senate Bill 26 alone, then what we're saying is that we're constantly drawing down the earnings reserve account balance.
So through the chair, Senator Kosak, just so I understand the question. The graphic here isn't limiting government spending. It's saying what it's saying on that. For example, on the gold bar, it's saying we as a legislature have a desire to spend $3 billion in UGF. We have $2.2 billion in UGF revenues, so we're going to go to the ERA for the rest. And in the current structure, you would have room to do that under the POMV. But in a $4.5 billion UGF scenario, you wouldn't. So what I've done here is said, don't just allow the legislature to overdraw. Just ignore the POMV. What does that do to the fund health?
So, and to make sure we're going apples to apples, as we talked a little bit about this, and it's a little bit more complicated, but when you're talking that apples to apples comparison, especially this year, as we're looking at the conversation of either splitting or combining UGF, DGF, and how those numbers flow, for the record, apples to apples, just do the gold ones. Just start there, $3 billion as far as actual operating capital expenses. And can you explain the difference of how it's being looked at this year for the total budget versus just the UGF? Because that gets in a little bit more complicated. Because one of the questions I have is, I had folks at the town hall a couple weeks ago. They said, why don't we just start with Governor Walker's budget? It's $4.8 billion, right? Those numbers are a little more wrapped up in there. It's not just a straight, you know, a $4.8 billion. So can you just break that down a little bit for the record when you're talking about this so that people understand? Because, again, we're a little apples to oranges here. Does that make sense, Mr. King?
I think that it does, Mr. Chairman. Let me see.
So if you were going to explain, let me ask it this way. So I'm one of the people that walked up to me and said, hey, why don't we just start with Governor Walker's budget? That should work just fine. It's reasonable. I heard that multiple times. Why won't that work as you're looking at the numbers and then that breakdown of apples to oranges? Or are we comparing apples to apples and UGF previously to your chart? Is that a better way of asking?
Perhaps. So, Mr. Chairman, the idea, so let's just use the $4.5 billion line just because it's closest to the number that you just referenced.
Sure.
So the goal of the legislature in that scenario is to spend $4.5 billion on UGF expenditures. In addition to that, there will be some payment of the dividend, we would assume, and there are revenues that are generated. So the question becomes how much revenues are generated, and in the current year that we're looking at now, that's about $2.2 billion. So that leaves you with $2.3 billion that you need to pay somehow. You can just take it out of the earnings reserve, and that if you do that, that's what that fund that's what happens to the fund in that case. Now, I am assuming that you are paying the full $1.9 billion dividend as well, which is not included in the $4.5 billion UGF here. So your total draw on the earnings reserve for that year is going to be, in that case, the 2.3 plus the 1.9, so 4.2, I think that works out too, that's what your draw in this year would be. That doing that is possible. The money is there, so logistically you could do that, but you will eventually run out of the ability to do that. The fund will go away.
Because you'll deplete the ERA.
Correct.
Okay.
And once the ERA is depleted, then you only have current year returns to pay whatever you want to spend them on. Inflation proofing, PFDs, government, whatever it is that you want to use those earnings for, you're restricted to just those earnings because there's nothing left.
And to also be clear, the SB 23 only lasts for how long?
3 years, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And that's a little bit of the difference in your graph chart about how fast,
correct,
how much, who would get there faster. Because we're circling a little bit back to finance again. Like I said, it's impossible to not make this a mini finance meeting just based on the category of the bills versus looking at the constitutional things. I think we've done that. Senator Machicki, another question?
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that the payback, essentially, if you think about the fact that you'd be using the earnings reserve to pay dividends, the payback ends the dividend in every one of these scenarios approximately 2 years earlier than if there was not a payback. If nothing else changes, but it does, all of these scenarios run down. And in the past, what we tried to do is find a formula that did not, that at least kept the earnings reserve constant, and in most cases with some growth. In every case, this is going to run you out probably around 2 years earlier than with full dividend, with payback. than if you didn't pay the payback.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I don't want to turn it into an OMB discussion either, but you're correct, and that's why the governor's complete package has a significantly reduced budget that can accept things like SB 23 that do not run the ERA into the ground by, you know, 2030. So I think that is part of the entire package and part of the reason for the reduced budget as well.
Follow up.
However, the $3 billion UGF is fairly close to the governor's and is still erode the earnings reserve with or without a payback.
Go ahead.
Senator Machicki, through the chair, the next slide might actually clarify that a little bit more if we want to move forward.
And we've had this debate, quite a healthy debate about this for several weeks now, because all these lines are going down. But I always want to underlay the permanent fund corpus, because that's going up. So it's the ERA is the account where the funds are being drawn from. But if you look at the permanent fund itself, it's up over $100 billion.
Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
I understand that, but am I correct that it's 6.55% earnings? No matter what the permanent fund does with the projected growth, you're still going to erode the earnings reserve, which is where the permanent fund dividend is paid from.
Senator Machicki, through the chair. So it's a little bit misleading, because those fund balances look like they're going down. It's tempting to say that that must mean that we're spending down the account. And so part of what's going on within the calculus of everything that's moving here is that every year money is being transferred from the earnings reserve to the principal account. So it's not leaving the fund, even though it's leaving the earnings reserve account. So the earnings reserve account is going down, but the fund balance is not.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
You are correct that the permanent fund continues to grow, but I am also correct that the earnings reserve account continues to be eroded under this scenario. Is that correct?
So, Senator Machicki, I know you want a yes or no answer, and I'm sorry that I have two hands. The answer to the question, you can think about it this way. If the fund is able to earn greater than the draw rate by the rate of inflation, so if right now the draw rate is 5%, right, 5% of the rolling lagging five-year average, if they end up earning 7.5% or more, then the fund is growing with the rate of inflation. The projection is 6.55%, which is less than that, which means that the total fund balance is not keeping up with inflation in the status quo. So what you're really seeing is that the problem lies in the fact that you're moving the money from the earnings reserve to the principal account for inflation proofing. You can get to the same result by just leaving the inflation proofing in the earnings reserve, and then you don't see that decline, and you end up in the same position. The only difference is that the legislature can spend it. But it doesn't change the balance of the fund at all.
So the answer is yes.
Yes.
Sorry.
Multiple hats. I get it. You good on that?
I'm good.
Okay. It took a while. Senator Kawasaki, go ahead, please.
Thanks for the straight answer. just really quick on the graph itself. Are these inflation adjusted dollars or actual dollars? It's a large span. It's a 20-year period. It continues to go down from a $17 billion to, in 2040, down to $10 billion. I'm just trying to understand where that's at.
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, these are all nominal dollars, so there's no inflation adjustment made to the value of these dollars. But the inflation is important because we want to protect the balance of the principal, which is why we move the money to the principal account. And so moving to slide 9, what you're seeing there is that the fund balance is increasing. That's mostly just increasing with the rate of inflation. There's a little bit of royalty deposits that are going on there that's generating some fund growth. But for the most part, the fund is only growing with inflation. So if I did an inflation adjustment, that would be a flat horizontal line or slightly inclined.
Would you like to investigate this further?
Isn't the fund growing with the earnings assumption as opposed to inflation? The Callan 6.55%?
Senator Michicki, through the chair, if the assumption is that the legislature is going to appropriate a full PFD and take the remaining amount of the money that they are allowed to take out of the fund, they're under the current law and the current projection, the 6.55%, the fund does not grow from earnings.
It only grows from inflation proof.
That, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. I should point that out. It does grow. It the principal account grows with inflation.
Anything else on this one? Next slide.
Turning to the next topic, Mr. Chairman, slides 10 through whatever they are. I think these are the last of our slides. The question was asked about what the 6.55% per year assumption often strikes people as an unrealistic assumption, and it is, right? There's an infinitely small probability that every year for the next 10 years, the return rates are going to be exactly 6.55%. It's going to be some other number, and we don't know. There are infinite number of possible outcomes on how the fund actually performs over the next decade or two. So what I wanted to do here was show a few of the scenarios that come out of a Monte Carlo simulation. So these are just completely random numbers that are generated from the probability distribution that the fund uses to show what a few of those futures look like. There's nothing special about any of these. They're not any more likely to occur than the 6.55% a year forever. There's nothing. They look more appealing because they mimic history, so it kind of conjures this image that it's more believable, but that's true in the same way that five random cards is just as unlikely as a royal flush, right? It's just, it looks different because it's something that we're looking for. So the first scenario, just again, there's randomly generated numbers. You can see on the left what those accounting returns look like over the next 10 years. They're just random numbers. Most of them are between 5 and 10%. We had one good year in this scenario where you had some 20-something percent. You also had a deep correction that immediately followed that. So it kind of mimics the history, and that's by design because the probability distribution that we're using is intended to mimic history to some extent. So then the question becomes, well, what does SB 23 do to this scenario? And so on the right, what you're seeing is the green line is what happens to the ERA balance over time under this scenario, and how does it change if SB 23 and 24 were to become law? So the green dotted line shows you what it looks like in the SB 23 scenario. And you can see, again, there's that delta between those two that represents the $2 or so billion that we're paying out of the fund. In this scenario, the fund is actually growing as long as you stay to the POMV. If you decide to overdraw, and in this case, I was trying to pay the FY19 budget growing with inflation and population, and allowing the legislature to overdraw the POMV in order to do that. And so what happens there is you're drawing more money out of the account. And so even though this is a really good scenario where we get decent returns, the earnings reserve balance doesn't grow until we get that spike in, it looks like, 2025 or so. And then the balance jumps up a little bit because you had that good return year. And then it kind of falls back down. So that's just one random scenario that shows you the difference between SB 23 and the other scenario. And it also gets to your point on how overdraws of the account change the fund performance and the fund's health. The scenario number two, is a less rosy picture. In this scenario, we had some not very good returns in 2020, an average kind of projected return in 21, and then a deep correction the year after that at -12%. So in this scenario, you do see the earnings reserve getting depleted, even if you do follow the POMV. And if you pass SB 23 and put those funds out of the account, you actually end up, in the year where you lose money, you end up not losing money because the money isn't in the fund, so it kind of helps a little bit in that specific year. But over time, since the fund is growing, you don't you don't see the kind of longevity in the fund that you would otherwise see in a different scenario. But what's important to note is that even in this scenario, the earnings reserve doesn't quite run out, and SB 23 doesn't quite get you to zero. It gets you pretty close, but it doesn't get you to zero. And so that's what I was talking about in the first meeting that we had on this bill, was there aren't very many scenarios where the earnings reserve almost runs out and then SB 23 causes it to run out. There's a lot of scenarios where it runs out in either case. There's a lot of scenarios where it does just fine. But there aren't a lot of scenarios where SB 23 is the problem.
I had a good question here. What is the UGF assumption for these charts as you made them?
The spending assumption for the ad hoc draws is the fiscal year 19, so $4.8 billion spend, and then growing with inflation and population. And you can see that if you do try to fund that budget and get these kinds of returns, the earnings reserve does run out. It runs faster under SB 23. But this is one of those complications because you're not running out the entire fund balance, so you're still earning returns on the principal. So it does end up putting more money back in the earnings reserve. Even though it goes to zero, it recovers or starts to recover. And then in this particular instance, you have a really negative last number on that chart, so it drains the account again. But it's really hard then to say, well, what does failure mean? Because is it failure at any point? Is it failure at the end? Is it failure because of SB 23? Is it failure because of some other factor? The scenario three, again, is just another random. In this case, we didn't have any market corrections. We had some pretty standard returns, nothing too surprising, but nothing negative either. So in this scenario, since you're beating the fund's projections in pretty much every year, the earnings reserve balance actually grows to over $40 billion. And if you pay out the SB 23, then it grows to $37 billion instead. So you're in good position in either case. Now, if you do fund the full FY19 budget from taking excess draws, then even in this really great scenario, you still only stay flat. I think that's my... there were two more questions or things of interest that came up. Were there other questions?
Just on that section, this is a great meeting, and I appreciate the information. I think what is clear is if everything goes fine with Senate Bill 23 and 24, everything will be fine. If historic impacts take place and we don't get the reductions, everything's not going to be fine. And I think if you just take it to that basic level, it helps all of us in the public understand why we're evaluating this so carefully. Is that a fair statement?
It is, Senator Michiki, a very fair statement. I think two things that you just pointed out that are really important. One is we don't know what the future is going to look like. And if things turn out well, then we don't have a problem. If things turn out poorly, then we do. So that's why we do these Monte Carlo simulations, to see how often one scenario comes up versus another, so you can understand what that risk looks like. But in every case, if you don't cut the budget, or if you draw more money out of the fund than is currently allowed, the fund is going to be – there are more situations where you end up in a bad outcome.
I appreciate that discussion. In fact, I wish I had said that. But the assumptions also are important, because the closer you get to a depletion, the less likely you're going to get a dividend type of thing. And then the inflation proofing and the POMV aren't what I would call exactly the same, but some people would say the POMV is your inflation proofing, and my guess is the closer you got to that becoming stressed, the less inflation proofing you're going to get. So that's why those lines are, they're an assumption, mm-hmm. but those are big pieces of that assumption, just to let you know, and so I'll take that into account as well.
And Bruce Tangeman again, I think the way we can limit risk, the way this administration has chosen to limit risk, is starting with the budget discussion, starting with available revenues, and then building up from there on what his vision of the budget should be. If we start with the FY19 budget and allow it to run, then we're hitting the CBR quick. Our risk profile goes up a lot higher. We have to have scenarios like this for a budget like that to happen. And reacting in 5 years, because if we do have a down market, the chess pieces on the table have been removed. If we're having an increasing growing budget from where it's at now over those coming years, our options are greatly, greatly reduced. So that's why Governor Dunleavy believes we need to tackle the spending problem now, give ourselves more area under that risk profile to absorb market corrections, et cetera. Just part of the bigger discussion, obviously.
And for the record, Ed King again, and on that point, I suppose I would talk about what you were talking about, Senator Coghill, with the assumptions that go through. When you build a model, just generally, you have to build in some logic. Models aren't smart enough to say, oh, if that happens, I would assess everything and then make a decision. You have to tell it what to do. And so my assumptions here in this model were that you, as the legislature, will follow the law. And you're correct that that might not be a good assumption. If earnings reserve of balance starts to get low, then you might decide not to inflation proof. You might decide not to pay the full PFD. You might decide to do many other things. And that's going to prolong the health, or not the health of the fund, but the balance of the fund. So in many of these cases where you do run to zero, in reality, you probably wouldn't because of the factors that you're talking about. That includes, you know, maybe if you have $10 billion in unrealized earnings, the legislature might tell the corporation, hey, I need you to sell a billion-dollar building because I need the money. You have that prerogative, but that's going to have impacts on the fund.
Follow up?
So my guess is the general public isn't totally watching us, but if they are, just a context to it. But even if they're not, I need to remind myself of that. So I just wanted to say it out loud to remind myself.
So we just spent an hour to basically say, it depends. Am I wrong?
You are not.
Correct. But this is good because we do have to have the debate, and there's a lot of levers to pull. We've seen that in finance, obviously, and what's available? What's the low-hanging fruit? Is it the dividend? Is that going to be taken down? Are we going to reduce spending? There's not a lot of options here. Or are we going to go for some kind of a tax? I mean, that's kind of what's on the table, really. So, I mean, that's also correct, right? I mean, what else do we have? So what's going to happen next? It depends. There you go. Anything else you'd like to
just the last two slides,
please?
Unless we're out of time.
No, no.
These are just questions that come up frequently when we talk about the repayment bill. So a lot of people are concerned about what those draws would do to the balance of the fund. And just to be clear, the governor views the money in the fund as excess to what the fund balance should be. So there's some nuance there that I don't know if you want to talk about.
I think you spoke to it perfectly.
Right, okay. Great. So from that perspective, these would not be losses. These would be returns to normal. Right? So you would, in that case, the status quo would be the green, and then the gold bar would be the alternative. What does it do to the future POMV? That question was asked. So when you take money out of the fund earns less money, and the fund balance is smaller, and so 5% of a smaller number is a smaller number. This is how that plays out. Because of the five-year averaging, you don't see the full effects for a few years. It takes a while before you get there, but eventually it stabilizes to right around $130 million a year in less earnings than if you keep the money in the fund. And that, I said earnings, but I shouldn't have. I said your POMV calculation will be $130 million less than it would have been if you left the money in the fund. And then what does it do to the PFD? A lot of people are interested in that. So you get the three additional payments in the next 3 years, but then the lower fund balance means you get lower PFDs forever after that. Just so that people are aware, if you are eligible for the payback and you were trying to decide whether you want the payback or the bigger dividends in the future, you break even after 30 years.
30 years. That's long. I hadn't heard that number yet. Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
Sir Machicki,
a couple of comments. In the previous slide, And just for context, you're talking about a Department of Public Safety-ish difference on the POMV draw. Just for context. The next slide, this can vary dramatically as well, because in the overdraw continuous growth of budget scenario, we're going to do what we can. We've got a challenging mix in the legislature. This can vary dramatically because that impact can hit much earlier and cause somewhat dramatic reductions or the elimination of the dividend much earlier than when you start seeing the impact in this chart. So again, that was the, if everything goes well, this will be great. If everything doesn't, could have fairly dramatic impacts on future dividends as well as every other aspect of the state economy.
Senator Michicki, through the chair, yes. The numbers that are shown here are an average of an infinite number of possible futures. And the reality will be, if I were to, I could actually run these numbers in those scenarios that I had shown earlier, and you could see kind of how it jumps around and what the difference, that delta looks like. That might be interesting. Maybe we'll talk about that in finance, I'm not sure. But thank you for the comments. It is correct. Thank you.
Life is a risk, isn't it? We can do nothing and be afraid and live at zero, or we can take risk and see what happens. I mean, that's part of what we're talking about here, right? Depending risk involved and what risk level we're willing to take and where we're all going to end up here in a couple months. 30 days, right? So 90 days, we're out of here. 30 days, we're all done. And that's our big, no, I know. Okay, sorry. It wasn't a very good joke. Bad day. All right, anything else on the slides, Mr. King? Mr. Tangeman, thank you very much for taking the time to explain this one. That took a little longer than I thought it might, but that's okay. We need to dig on this one because it goes to finance next. So thanks for taking the time. And anybody else have any other comments on this right now? And we're going to continue into the day. All right. We're going to, unfortunately, we wanted to, we're going to go ahead and set aside 23 and 24, SB 23 and 24. I had intended to bring up SB 33 today, but we had scheduling conflict with the Department of Law, so we will pick it up next week. We have asked if anybody has intent for amendments to go ahead and get them to us tomorrow by 6 p.m. if you do. The intent will be to amendments heard on Tuesday, and then hopefully, if we can, go ahead and move this bill out of committee. So we'll... that we'll just see how it goes. The concludes our business for today. Senate State Affairs will meet again Tuesday, March 12, 2019 at 3:30 p.m. back here in this room to pick up 23 and 24 dealing with those prior year PFDs. And then hopefully if we have time, we'll get on into SB 33, arrest, release, sentencing, probation at 6 p.m. We will do public testimony as well that evening, is just FYI. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:41.